Now, on the 15th of June this year, we're marking the 800th anniversary of the signing of the original Magna Carta, albeit unwillingly by King John. The charter had originally been drafted by the Archbishop of Canterbury in an effort to make peace between a group of rebel barons and the unpopular king. Now, I've been joined today by John Devenham, who, along with Andrew Summers, are joint authors about a new book about this event and its connection with Essex. So first off, John, welcome to Felix FM again, and perhaps you could provide us a brief background as to how and why the Magna Carta came about.
Well, I'll give it my best shot. First off, let's get one thing straight. King John did not sign the Magna Carta. Nobody signed it. It was sealed with the royal seal.
Right.
But a minor detail. To put things in context, in 1215, King John had been at war in France trying to reclaim his hereditary lands. And now, wars were expensive, and under the feudal system in England, it was the nobility that were obliged to supply men, armour and horses, as well as provisioning the armies, but most of all, money. The money was raised by the king's ever more harsh taxes. But John's wars were a series of disasters. Everything that could go wrong went wrong.
Feeling.
Yeah, well.
I think we all do.
Many of these barons that were later rebels initially supported the king, and they fought with him in France. But by 1214, they were fed up with the draining the country of resources and, more importantly, their estates, just to fight losing battles. At the same time, there was a squabble with the Pope and King John over who should be the Archbishop of Canterbury. The Pope dug his heels in and excommunicated the whole country. Now, that was very serious. For a few years, people could not marry, be baptised, or be buried properly. This wreaked havoc with ordinary people's lives, and coupled with a run of bad harvests and the excessive taxes that they were being asked to pay, things had to change. King John made peace with the Pope eventually, and then he was hell-bent on resuming his fights in France, but that was the last straw for the barons, who rebelled, and at Runnymede they presented a set of demands drawn up by Stephen Langton, who was King John's choice as Archbishop of Canterbury. Now, this document that they presented was called the Articles of the Barons, and it was what would become the Magna Carta. And one of its stipulations was that a committee of 25 of these barons should be elected by themselves to ensure that the king abided by his agreement.
Now, you made the comment there, or at least I made the comment to start with, saying that King John was very unpopular. But in fact, he was saying that he wasn't as bad and nasty a piece of work as he's been made out to be. Is that right?
Well, he was a nasty piece of work on a personal level. He was acknowledged by most historians as an excessively cruel person. He was ruthless, but he did put systems in place that kept the country running. That's running in his own personal style,
right,
which was really to create money so that he could retake lands in France and
benefit
the country. But
okay, well, let's go back to the rebellious barons, and a good many of those came from Essex, did they not? And I think you were also saying that although they've been pictured as being the nice guys and the good guys in this, they also had their faults, did they not?
Well, they did. I mean, there were the Essex barons that we've featured in this book are virtually the leaders of the rebellion. At least certainly played a very strong role in the rebellion. They were led by Robert Fitzwalter, Lord of Dunmo, who styled himself as Marshal of the Army of God.
no point in being big-headed.
Absolutely. Yeah. But, I mean, the rest of them were Richard de Montfichet, Sheriff of Essex, and he actually owned the land at Runnymede where the Magna Carta was sealed. Geoffrey de Mandeville of Plessy, William de Lanvalle, Governor of Colchester Castle, and Robert de Vere of Castle Headingham. Now, they were five of the leaders and very prominent in the rebellion. Now, they were all hereditary from the time of William the Conqueror.
Mm-hmm.
And at William's time, all the Saxon lords were kicked out, basically, of their estates, and these estates were all given to these people, who were cohorts of William the Conqueror, or their forebears, anyway.
Mm-hmm.
So those five were all, as I said, leaders of the rebellion. The exception was Hubert de Burgh, who was the king's chief minister, who controlled Rayleigh Castle.
Right.
And another thing he did, he built Hatley Castle that later on.
Ooh.
But he was one of the king's very loyal, and he stayed loyal to the king all through the ensuing wars that went on. And keeping an eye on all these things that are happening, were the chroniclers of the day. One of the most important to us was Ralph, the abbot of Coggeshall. His writings are one of the most used primary sources of information for the ensuing events and the later death of King John.
Which was, the following year?
Yes, that was in 1216. Yeah. And that, the dying of King John was the catalyst for bringing the Magna Carta back to life.
Hang on, we're getting ahead of ourselves, aren't we, here? Because how was it that the original Magna Carta then became null and void?
Yeah, well, we are getting ahead of ourselves. As I said, then the catalyst for bringing the Magna Carta back to life was the death of John. Well, it was bringing it back to life because the Carta was eventually dead and was actually dead and buried almost within weeks of it being sealed at Runnymede. Because King John reneged on the agreement, declaring that he had been put under such duress to agree to it. And he appealed to the Pope for support, and the Pope issued a papal bull declaring that the Charter was illegal, unjust, and shameful to the English people, and harmful to the royal rights. Because at that time, it was the king was his word was law, and he had divine right to rule as he saw fit. But he also had to pay obeisance to the Pope. The Pope was his spiritual, the head of
head of the
all
church,
countries.
Head of, yeah. So what was the inevitable result of that?
Well, the inevitable result was the barons had been... Their committee of 25 barons led by the Essex lot had been committed to seeing that the king abided by the agreement. When he reneged on it, the result was war.
Right, and they decided he'd got to go.
They did. They decided that John would have to go. And to this end, they invited Prince Louis of France, as Philip II's son, to support them and become the king.
Which, of course, there were connections, strong connections between England and France because of the Norman conquest.
Yes, yeah.
Mm.
And there were all King John's ancestors, his brother Richard, Richard the Lionheart, and Eleanor of Aquitaine were far more French than they ever were English.
Yes.
So and this Philip Louis, Prince Louis, he had a tenuous claim to the throne. He was the maternal grandson-in-law of King John's father, Henry II.
Oh, right. So, what about the results of the war? I guess that they must have been felt across Essex.
Well, they were. They were very much. Essex was a hotbed of revolt. And King John, the barons had thrown the gauntlet down. King John responded by thinking, I've got to nip this in the bud. Mm-hmm. So he embarked on a campaign starting with Essex. The first conflict was Stanstead Mount Fitchett Castle,
right,
the seat of Richard Montfichet. It was destroyed totally.
Mm-hmm.
Richard wasn't in the castle at the time, fortunately for him. Even though he had fought with King John at Poitou in France, and he had had some of his ancestral lands previously confiscated restored to him by the Runnymede Agreement. But he was firmly in the rebel camp.
And presumably he lost them all again.
He lost them all again. His whole estates were... There was a price on his head and his whole estates were confiscated to the crown. Now, with his castle in ruins and Richard gone, the garrison dispersed, it was time for the local villagers to take the opportunity to do a spot of looting of their own.
There's a surprise.
Well, yeah. I mean, the peasantry had very little to gain from whoever was winning the war.
Hmm.
In fact, they suffered whichever army passed through their territory, they suffered, whether it was the barons or the kings.
Hmm.
So they took this opportunity to take what they could from anything that was salvageable from within the castle.
Hmm. So what happened? Headingham, Pleshy, Colchester Castle, so...
Yeah, Headingham was next.
Mm.
And, well, I think it was Pleshy that came next. And that was taken. It was not destroyed. It was taken. I think the garrison gave up without a fight to the superior forces of King John's. Headingham was next. Colchester Castle was seized in turn. But neither of these three were harmed the king, the superior forces. Sort of, I think they probably scared the pants off the incumbents, and the garrisons all gave up without a fight.
But
to save their castles.
But Colchester Castle changed hands a few times, did it not?
It changed hands about five times during the two wars of the Barons' War.
But
mostly it changed hands through discussion.
Oh, really?
Yes. As there is in any war, before or since then, there's a convention that... you ask for discussions first, and in Colchester Castle, for example, the king's forces were arraigned there.
Yeah.
They would send an emissary to the castle.
Yeah.
The castle would send somebody out with a white flag, and they would discuss terms and conditions, and if they were favourable, they would say, OK, we'll submit, you can take over, rather than all lose their lives.
But with all of this going on, it looks like the king held most of the cards, didn't he?
Well, it might seem so, yes. But the government had broken down.
Mm.
The treasury was bankrupt. But John was winning the war. He'd taken control of all the castles in Essex and was on his way north into Suffolk, and Framlingham Castle in Suffolk was his next spot, and that fell without loss of life. And he continued on his way north. Ostensibly, he was going to travel north to join up with some of the his other forces that were coming down from Scotland. But unfortunately, he fell ill and died.
Dear.
Yeah.
October, bad timing for him.
In October 1216, he was allegedly one of the chroniclers of the time. Matthew Paris tells us that the king died from overeating too many lampreys. but, you know, that's what truth there is in that, who knows. But he die he did, and before he died, his wagon trains with everything that he owned, the crown jewels included, allegedly, tried to get across the Wash at where the River Nene comes into the Wash, and the whole bag and baggage of the lot disappeared into the quicksands of the Wash. So poor old John was dead with everything about him gone.
So who took over?
Well, he realised he was dying and set up a Regency Council headed by one of his most loyal supporters, William Marshall. And he let it be known that William Marshall would be the protector of John's 9-year-old son, who he nominated as his successor, Henry III. And that's what happened. Letters were sent out to everybody of authority in the country, ordering them to recognise Henry as king, and offering pardons and safe conduct to all the rebels who returned to be loyal to the new king.
So what happened then?
Well, William Marshall was, again, reputed by chroniclers of the time to be the wisest man in Christendom, and in a bold move to restore peace and order, he reissued a modified version of the Magna Carta. Prince Louis was sent packing. It took a handsome payoff to get him to go, but he abandoned all claims to the English crown. And the rebels all returned to the fold, all swore allegiance to Henry III. In return for that, most of them, their lands and estates were all restored to them.
That's quite amazing, really.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah.
And Henry then, did he not reissue the charter again?
Well, he did. When he was a little older, in 1225, he reissued the charter again, even with even more modifications.
Yes.
And it was, I mean, the charter was repeatedly reissued. In fact, it was reissued in 1297 by Edward I. And it became part of England's statute law at that time. But even after that, for centuries, various monarchs had tweaked the charter, improved it, added bits, taken bits off, and it was it combined to become part of common law.
So, I mean, as you said, the rebels really were restored, basically, right across. They didn't really suffer as a result of this.
They were. I mean, it's amazing that despite being on the losing side and supporting a foreign prince in a bid to take the English crown from 9-year-old Henry...
It's quite astonishing.
The barons remained quite well off. None of them were killed in action, although one died in a jousting accident, but most were captured at Lincoln, and the final battle of Lincoln in 1217. And they were imprisoned. But then, following the Treaty of Lambeth in September that year, all of them regained their freedom, and nearly all had their titles and lands restored.
Incredible. But what effect did the signing have on ordinary people in Essex?
On ordinary people...
people like you and me.
It's easy to say that the Magna Carta had very little effect, but it did have an effect. See, in 1215, all of Essex was designated forest.
Right.
I mean, and that didn't mean it was a wooded area, but it was an area of unenclosed countryside.
Right.
And it was designated forest, meant it was royal hunting grounds. But all who lived and worked in the forest were subject to the forest laws, which were superior to all the courts of the land, And more importantly, they were subject to change on the whim of the king. Now, the charter curtailed the king's power on the forest laws.
Mm-hmm.
Many changes were made, which really did benefit the ordinary people. It meant that they could easier graze their cattle and their pigs, and they could collect wood for their fires and fuel.
Mm. Probably took a little bit of time to filter it out.
But it was a start.
Mm.
Yeah, I mean, most men and women were tied to their feudal overlords, the barons, and some of them, as I've said before, were not as nice a people as you might think they were. But the common man was, during the wars, he was likely to find his village and home burnt and his crops and livestock stolen by armies of whatever side.
Yeah.
And, you know, he would have a not a very nice life.
I can imagine. Now, in any event, from what you said, 15th of June 1215 is probably rather academic, because it was not until 1225 or perhaps even 1297 that the Magna Carta, as we know it, really came into its own. Is that not so?
Well, it's in some ways it is, but not really, because from day one of the barons meeting with the king at Runnymede, there was a curbing of the arbitrary power of the king. And it was a case of little by little things began to improve. I mean, each time the charter was reissued, it has to be said that the beneficiaries in the main were the barons, but there were tiny improvements from day one. And it's gone on for, 800 years?
Right.
With tiny improvements.
Now, I know your book makes reference to a large number of Essex places that seem to have links with King John and the Magna Carta, such as King John's School in Benfleet, Runnymede Hall and Runnymede Swimming Pool in Thundersley, to name just a couple. But in spite of your efforts, your researchers have failed to uncover any reasons. Do you think it's just that the names were picked by individuals who've long since gone the way of all men?
Well, we can't find hard evidence of... But in for example, there have been hunting lodges in Essex. There is one well-known one, which is well-documented at Riddle, which is now on the site of the Agricultural College in Riddle. There's further south in Benfleet in Thundersley. There's a hunting lodge, or there was a hunting lodge in the Chase at Thundersley, and another one at Jarvis Hall in Thundersley Park Road.
Yeah.
Now, John is reputed to have stayed at this latter palace in Jarvis Hall near Kenneth Road, and he was quite possibly entertained by Hubert de Burgh, the builder of nearby Hadley Castle.
Right.
Now, King John's School in Shipwright's Drive is allegedly built on the site of this royal hunting lodge.
Mm-hmm.
For some reason, Benfleet seems to have taken King John and its Magna Carta connections to heart. All these names seem to have been designated during the middle of the last century. 1949, King John's School was opened. In 45 and 53, between 45 and 53, Runnymede Chase was named, behind the Castle Point Borough Council offices. There's a Runnymede Road on Canvey Island, which was adopted in the 60s, and there's another Runnymede Road in 1950s in Stanford Le Hope.
There's quite a lot of these.
Nowhere else in the country is there an accumulation of places with these sort of names. And we thought that was quite odd, but we, as I said, the hunting lodges in Thundersley and Benfleet are long gone, and there's no trace.
Anyway, what's the official name of the book? When's it going to be released, the price, and where can you get it from?
Well... It's called Magna Carta in Essex.
Mm-hmm.
It's priced at $7.99, and you can get it from all good bookshops.
As they say.
yeah, all good bookshops. Even some of the bad ones might have it. I'm a book writer. There are no bad bookshops. You can get it direct from the publishers, Essex 100 Publications, online at www.essex100.com.
Well, all right. Thanks very much indeed for coming in today, telling us all about this fascinating book about such an important cornerstone of our history. I'm sure it's going to do very well, and we look forward to seeing you again whenever you bring out your next project.